You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of April 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, the United States ban on travellers from countries that Donald Trump dislikes faces the scrutiny of the Supreme Court. My guests Michael Goldfarb and Somnath Battabile will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Finland's abandonment of its experiment in doling out free money, Bavaria's apparent belief that state buildings are basically naked without a cross affixed to them, and...
We do have a very special... relationship. In fact, I'll get that little piece of dandruff off. We have to make him perfect. He is perfect.
President Emmanuel Macron's visit to Washington prompts a reappraisal of everything we thought we knew about body language. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Somnath Battabile, lecturer in media and development and international journalism at SOAS, and Michael Goldfarb, the author and broadcaster. Welcome both. We will start in the United States, where the Supreme Court is hearing arguments on a third version of President Donald Trump's so-called Muslim ban, a key campaign promise to make life more difficult for visitors and prospective immigrants from a few whimsically chosen countries. The first iteration caused memorable chaos in American airports, almost as if nobody had thought the thing all the way through. The most recent version was allowed to take effect last December, pending this current appeal. Somnath, let's start by looking at the actual list. There are seven countries on it. Syria, Libya, North Korea, Iran, Yemen, Somalia, and Venezuela. Would make an excellent pub quiz question. Is there any rhyme or reason there in the choosing those seven of all the countries on Earth?
Chad has been taken off very recently.
Exactly. Yeah. Chad is off the hook.
Well, Venezuela and North Korea makes it slightly more difficult for Supreme Court to rule it down on religious grounds. For once, the third time, Trump and his administration might have been smart. The first two iterations were so bad. I mean, the first one was knocked off immediately. The second one, after a quick couple of legal appeals. So this one, there is this conversation which has just started that whether the legality of it will hold. The Supreme Court has given an indication in last December, as you just said, that a version of it has been allowed to go ahead, overruling a compromise of the last June. So there, now suddenly there's this conversation that whether in court this will stand up to scrutiny. This is supposedly a tighter one than the last two. And it seems so. I do agree that putting these two countries in has been a strategic moment.
Michael, are there ever grounds for just basically pulling up the drawbridge on an entire nationality on national security grounds?
In this day and age? I mean, I suppose there are, but that's not what this is about, right? I mean, that's a separate question from the case that was just, actually the arguments are just kind of closed over in Washington. I don't know. I can't think of one. The counter case would be, well, in fact, it was asked today, just an hour or two ago, in court. One of the more conservative justices asked the lawyer who is defending the idea that the ban should be illegal, but what if the president had absolute proof, for example, that 20 agents from Syria had been sent towards the United States with some extraordinary chemical weapon? Wouldn't it be all right then? As a hypothetical.
That's a bit of a cross that bridge when we get to it issue, isn't it?
Well, that's how I would say it. That's how I answered the question you put, Andrew. But in fact, the lawyer said, well, I mean, if it's a hypothetical, well, then yes, obviously the president should have in that moment and with, you know, properly vetted, you know, intelligence information from his spy agencies, the right to say nobody from Syria can come in until we've sorted this out. That wasn't the case, of course, when this ban was put in place. And the legal question, and the reason it's got this far to the Supreme Court through three iterations is, throughout his campaign, Trump's stump speech was, you know, I'm just going to keep all Muslims out. And then within weeks of getting it sworn in, he chooses seven predominantly Muslim nations and just willy-nilly says, you can't come in. And so the case proceeds from that. Does the Constitution allow him to protect America in exceptional circumstances? Yes. does someone who has created a kind of verbal trail of bigotry and becomes president, does he have the right then to say, I can do whatever I like and ban whoever I like? And that's where the question is. I'm not sure that the Supreme Court will see it the way I've just explained it. And I do wonder if they're going to kind of say, well, in this case, the president has the right to do what he wants.
Somnath, does even attempting to pass legislation like this, and I'm reminded somewhat of Brexit, which the vote for which I think was substantially driven by anti-immigration sentiment. But whether or not it ever actually happens, does it have what is the desired effect for the people behind it anyway, in that it makes the country seem like a less welcoming place, therefore immigrants just stop coming of their own accord?
Yes, you're right. Absolutely. I mean, Britain today is a less welcoming place than it was when I came in 15, 20 years ago to study. Today, my friends in India, or even my cousins, younger relatives, they do not want to come to Britain anymore. Australia is more a choice. Canada is more a choice. So, of course, I think in this setting out what Michael has just said, that Trump's stump speech was ban all Muslims to come in. In that, he has been more or less successful, that in the last 1 year, America is a far less welcoming place to immigrants. Post-70s, 80s, America was a country which was taking in the most number of immigrants. So, you know, this has completely changed. But whether the case, what the Supreme Court judge has said, that whether 20 agents from a particular country comes in and attacks on American soil, given the extreme vetting, there seems to be almost no scope of that happening statistically. 300 million to one chance that an American citizen will be killed by somebody who has been vetted and comes into a country. That almost is a statistical impossibility. So the question the conservative judge asks is extremely hypothetical.
And there was another hypothetical posed by the liberal justice, Sotomayor Kagan, I can't remember. But anyway, the thing was, suppose a future president is anti-Semitic and says, well, I'm going to ban any visitation from Israel. How would you feel about that as a hypothetical? And the government lawyer said, well, that would be a pretty out-of-the-box president. She said, yeah, we've got a pretty out-of-the-box president.
That's what's known in the trade as a self-making case.
And of course, what happens is that we're discussing this, but I mean, law is based on precedent.
Yeah.
You know, the Supreme Court, part of its job is to set the precedents that then in the future guide jurisprudential decisions in America. So if they say, well, yes, the president has this power, he can make these summary decisions on his own without recourse to Congress, without any other check, then 20 years from now, in a different situation with an even more extreme president, God knows what could happen.
Okay, well, let's move along now slightly, or actually quite extremely, a long way away, to Finland, which is the only European jurisdiction thus far to have tried out the currently fashionable idea of a universal basic income, that is, just giving people money to do with what they will. Finland's basic income experiment was not exactly universal. It was just 2,000 unemployed Finns chosen at random, who were given €560 a month each. The two-year pilot scheme was launched 1 year ago, but it has now been announced that it will not be expanded. Somnath, just the basic idea of the universal basic income, is it basically a good idea? I mean, obviously everyone likes the idea of free money, but there are obvious issues around that which we will get to. But basically, is it a good idea?
To me, absolutely yes. Not in the sense that I would want free money, but as a state, the idea of the welfare state from the 1920s till the 1970s took on a large paternal role, especially in the West. That, since the 1970s, post-Reagan and Thatcher, has been rudely and abruptly interrupted. This was an unbelievable leap, I thought, which only countries like Finland and Scandinavian countries could have made. So I was delighted. The last 2 years, such a small scale, almost nothing has been gained. We might have been pushed back a bit further. But as a concept that, yes, you can have money to do what you will with it. No one is going to ask accounts of you. No one is going to ask you to pay it back, that you can have a decent life with it. or whatever that 500, 600 euros does, I think was a fantastic idea.
Is the problem that with this experiment, Michael, that one, that it wasn't universal, and two, that 560 euros a month in Finland does not buy you terrifically much?
Well, I mean, it'll keep you sober, won't it? I mean, you can't really afford to go out too many nights in a week on that. Yeah, it wasn't enough, and it wasn't widespread enough. But what I find interesting is that we went for decades just arguing about, as Sumnath was saying, you know, the tearing apart of the social safety net, the welfare states that post-war in Europe were established and eased people along since the advent of Thatcher and Reagan in the 80s and elsewhere after that has grown weaker. But suddenly the idea is back. Why is the idea back? Because guys out in Silicon Valley are making tons of money inventing all kinds of applications and robotics that will make work irrelevant eventually for 90% of the planet. I mean, other than, you know, people who are tilling the soil at a subsistence level, most, I mean, they'll program someone to talk just like me, and they'll even clone my voice. But what I think that it's a real problem, and I disagree with Sumnath on this. I just did a documentary about marking the 50th anniversary of the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, who in their last year of life were working very closely on economic justice issues in America. And Dr. King was the first major public figure I can think of who advocated universal basic income. America was rich enough. There's a hardcore group of people who can never find work, and there should always be money to get them through. Bobby Kennedy, on the other hand, argued with him, said, no, work is actually almost more important than the money. The act of working gives you self-worth. In our societies, and no one has come up with something better, work is the force that gives us meaning.
Advocates of universal basic income say, of course, that the point is that if you give it especially to people who don't have work, then it frees them up to actually look for work or to establish their own businesses. Because it is, I think it's an underestimated or undervalued component of poverty, which is that it's incredibly time-consuming being poor, just getting the very basic stuff done. And it's also, again, ironically, weirdly expensive in that you can't actually save. You're forever worried about where the next payment and the next meal is coming from, and therefore you can't plan ahead. But Sumnath, is there any way that you can actually solve the political problem of something like this? And a similar proposal was rejected by the Swiss at a referendum in 2016, is that there is still, partly I think for the reasons that Michael mentions, that work is seen as inherently virtuous, people really resent other people not working if they are working.
I mean, you know, let's take UK as the example for a short period of time. The virulent conversation we have about benefit scroungers, people who cheat the benefit system, and therefore should the state coming down on it. Less than 1% of the GDP is spent on it. Much more goes into health, education, which we don't talk about, and which of course necessary. So the percentage of money which is spent actually on benefits is very little. People who might be able to circumvent the system at times, again, would be so minuscule that in the larger scheme of things, it shouldn't be adding up to the national conversation. So I don't agree with it. As far as the conversation about job and self-respect goes, I completely agree with Michael that there should be nothing taken away from it, that yes, individuals get worth and self-respect from working. But as Andrew, you are pointing out, a basic minimum level gives you a decency and time and dignity to look for such positions.
Well, but what's interesting?
The utopian version of universal basic income, and this is what I'll put to you each in turn, you first, Michael, finally. Say that the politics and the economics could be squared. Someone could figure out how this wouldn't be massively inflationary, although I can't see that it wouldn't be. But supposing the government of this country decided to bestow upon every resident, let's say for the sake of argument, 1,000 quid a month. To do with what you like. How, first of all, Michael, would that change your life?
Actually, it would. I'm not sure that it would change it a great deal. And I think that even for people who are living in poverty, because we come back to this, in this country, I don't think people begin to understand how difficult it is to be poor, because, you know, I went to a council estate in Middlesbrough, met a woman. Her three kids are unemployed. They're in their 20s and 30s. When they go for a job, to look for a job so they can get their dole, they have to show they've been out. The amount of money they spend getting from this estate, which is an hour bus ride away. Mm. The bus comes three times a day. They're standing out there in the rain. I mean, people don't understand how difficult it is to be poor in Britain. It's not like being poor in Santa Monica, California, where the weather's nice and you can sleep on the beach. You know, don't laugh. There's a reason why there's a huge homeless population in Santa Monica. But, I mean, I don't want to get carried away. I will say this. Bernie Sanders yesterday gave a speech. He didn't offer universal basic income. He said in 2020, America should offer every American who is physically capable of work a job. And that's the way to get money into people's pockets.
Somnath, say that extra grand a month, how would it make any difference to you personally?
To my lifestyle, yes. I'm in that kind of lower middle income level, which £1,000 would help. But the what I would want to just kind of add to this is that when you come, the difference in poor families and the middle class children here, which I am involved with being in the education business, I see that difference, you know, every day. So a guaranteed income for, especially for the youth, would, I think, massively. I mean, again, if you target it well, if you find the right income group and the right social categories, then this thing would definitely help. But Finland has taken a huge backward step, I think.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Michael Goldfarb and Somnath Battabile. Coming up next, compulsory crosses in Bavaria.
Monocle's May issue invites you to hang out with the world's brightest-eyed, bushiest-tailed new world leader. Jacinda Ardern is New Zealand's Prime Minister on a mission to turn her lively first 100 days in office into years of growth and good vibrations. Talking of which, we switch to California, dreaming of a modernist Mecca under cloudless skies, happy people in lovely homes. We're moving to LA, incidentally. Elsewhere, let us show you fauna, dogs like this guy, coughing cartoons like these, porcelain pets, pussies, pilchards. We also suspend our disbelief with a visit to the studio of the artist and the set designer Ez Devlin, who's done big things for Adele and Beyoncé. We take five with jazz saviour Kamasi Washington, we sit pretty and count down our 50 favourite design innovations and marvel at Belgrade's Palace of Serbia and its marble rigour and surreal spotlessness. It's always a good time for a glass of something fortifying, of course, and so we have a vino with Adam Gopnik, hello Adam, a flirtini in Yokohama, and finish the bottle with these kiwis. And we're back to New Zealand then. Why are these suitcases smiling? Well, now you know why. Monocle's May issue is out now. Get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Somnath Battabile and Michael Goldfarb. To Bavaria next, where the local government appears to have solved literally every last actual problem besetting every last one of its citizens. Such, at least, is the only conclusion which can reasonably be drawn from the news that the state authorities have the time, resources and energy to pass a law making compulsory the placing of crosses at the entrances to all public buildings. Premier Marcos Soda said that the instantly recognisable religious symbols should not be seen as religious symbols, but instead as a clear avowal of our Bavarian identity and Christian values. Michael, what in the wide world of sports is Premier Soda talking about?
Well, I don't know. I have a feeling that there's a monk sitting in northern Germany on the can, working out another 95 theses to tell those Catholics in Bavaria where to stick that cross. I don't know. You know, this is all part of, there's a hysteria that has swept right-wing European culture on both sides of the Atlantic that is really disheartening and worrying. And, you know, people are entitled to their faith.
Of course.
And it is the hallmark of how ignorant people are of history, that they don't understand that the way the West got to where it is and managed to take over so much of the world in part was because they finally figured out you get religion out of public life, keep it private, and then everybody is kind of free. Of course, now you have a lot of Muslims coming in, but And there were always Jews around, but they killed a lot of Jews. It's just a bad precedent, particularly in Bavaria. Dachau is at the edge of Munich, which is the capital of Bavaria. I just think it's a ridiculous idea. But, you know, in some ways, it's just gesture politics taken to the nth level. And I don't know the constitution of that particular Lande. I mean, if you tried that in America, you'd have a national...
Well, people do try it in America from time to time. You get the occasional Yahoo judge in Alabama or Mississippi who tries to put the Ten Commandments on the front steps.
And look what happens when they run for Senate, and it turns out that they've been feeling up 14-year-old girls. You know, they give Christianity a bad name.
Somnath, is this just your basic populist grandstanding, or is there anything more sinister underpinning it?
I hope it's the former, in all likelihood, it's the former because, you know, elections are coming up. There is, as Michael so eloquently put, a right-wing hysteria which is going on. This is anti-Muslim fervor which is sweeping across the Atlantic on both sides. So elections and politics are definitely driving this. I hope this. It's not ideological. But, of course, the state has no business to be in religion, especially in the West.
Does the state then, because obviously there is the opposite extreme, as observed certainly in France and other parts of not just Europe, but even the Middle East, of excluding religious symbols from all state property and all state premises? This is an approach with which I am not unsympathetic myself. Just the idea of reinforcing rigorously that this is a private affair. It is none of the state's business.
It shouldn't be. And as you say, in countries in the Middle East, in India, at this point of time, religion is playing such a large role and a very detrimental role. So whenever state has muddled with religion, whenever nation states, especially in the West, which has set a lovely 150 years of precedence of just trying to slowly leave religion behind, whenever it muddles with it, you see in America, you'll see in Germany now, you see in India, things go wrong.
Michael, do you think that we mentioned the examples where there is the occasional clash between church and state in the United States. Is that still accepted as an article of faith in America that the two should be separate?
Less and less. And the current coming together of, you know, Donald Trump, whose you know, base has a tremendous evangelical Christian character, although I try never to say evangelical Christian. I mean, I think they're political Christians. They use their Christianity as a political battering ram, and evangelical elevates it to something that it's not, which is why Roy Moore, you know, it gets found out. I think that at the moment it's dangerous in that for decades now people have said, well, you know, really the United States is a Christian country because it was founded by Christian slave owners and merchants. And one, that argument doesn't hold up to genuine historical scrutiny. But two, you know, it really was founded by people who we're only 100 years from the writings of Spinoza and Locke, the foundational texts of separating church and state. And they lived it. They lived it in France as well. They went a little too far in France. You know, they emptied out Notre Dame and turned it into a temple of reason.
Well, this cues up nicely the final item for consideration, because we go back to Washington, D.C., which has been entertaining French President Emmanuel Macron on the first full-blown state visit hosted by President Donald Trump. And as has been noted on previous encounters between the pair, there is something about Macron that elevates Trump's always awkward body language into bold new realms of gaucherie. Macron has generally attracted quite good reviews for his handling of Trump, and it tells us much that the President of the United States is so often discussed in terms more usually applied to a farmyard animal. But how much can we really glean about their relationship from a few excruciating photo opportunities? Somnath, do you share my suspicion that throughout every encounter with Trump, Macron is basically struggling to keep a straight face?
I think so. I remember the first meeting which they had, where Macron just veered off towards Angela Merkel and then gave that very heavy handshake to Trump, and there was much discussion.
Very, very long handshake.
Yes, and, you know, kind of they had a grappling session. So I don't know about this bromance and this photo opportunities and kissing on the cheeks and washing away of dandruff, all this business going on. But what is important to note is that Macron doesn't seem to have come away with anything substantial, not on Syria, not on Iran, not on the trade agreements, so not on the Paris climate deal. So I don't know if anything substantial has been achieved. He seems to be saying that there are steps they have taken forward, but Trump seems to be contradicting him immediately.
Michael, how do you account for sort of Trump regarding Macron as the son he wished he'd had? And frankly, given the sons Trump actually has, who can blame him? There's something quite wistful about it from Trump's point of view, I think.
You could interpret it that way.
I just have.
I know. I'm agreeing with you, Andrew, in a very English way, even though I'm only a Brit by acquired passport. I'm not English. Look, I don't know. It seems to me, if a guy comes up and touches me on the shoulder to get rid of dandruff, I'm decking him.
Who are you? This is why you're not president of France, Michael.
Exactly right. Exactly. If he tries it with Angela Merkel tomorrow,
they'll be held
he's
to
in
pay.
Trouble. No, I mean, look, you know, nobody knows what goes on. And in fact, his chief of staff doesn't know what's going on from moment to moment. So anybody who's trying to, when we who are on the other side of the Atlantic try to impose some kind of narrative on what we see in the pictures and read into the body language or whatever, I just think it's all speculation. And I think that even Macron, face-to-face, has to come away thinking, well, we went over all this stuff about Iran, and he very cleverly, as I mean, the line coming out of the Beltway, even as we speak, is that Macron played a clever game, and he gets that you have to make Trump think it's his idea. So if Trump is skeptical about the nuclear deal with Iran, you've got to make him think that it's a good idea to stay in it, but we can build on it. And apparently that was what Macron's message was. But, you know, that decision isn't until the middle of May. And that's, what, 3 weeks away? And in 3 weeks, have you got any idea how many twists and turns?
But, Michael, do you think they at all rehearse this before this fluffing away the dandruff behind the scenes and then come out and enact it?
No. I think he acts in the... The one thing I think is absolutely true is he's in the moment. As the actors say, I'm in the moment, man. And it's like... With him, it's the
Trump in the zone.
he's just in his own world, and I'm not kidding. You know, when your chief of staff, General John Kelly, has no idea from second to second what he's going to do or what he's going to say, no one does except, and not even Trump. It's all very spontaneous, and that's what makes him so frightening. You know, because there are some things one hopes that in a crisis, right? There'll be two or three people in the room who will actually make the decision for him. But in charting a major diplomatic decision like this, the fact that no one really knows, the Europeans who signed the JCPOA don't know, Russia doesn't know, Iran doesn't know, and they won't know until May the 12th. And it's really weird.
Somnath, can you generally really tell much by the degree to which two given leaders appear to get on or not?
At times, yes, but I see your skepticism and where, because there's a large team behind the presidents and prime ministers who work deals out. But with Trump, you know, you almost there's this, as you're saying.
That the minor thing that can be said for him is that what you see is actually
what you get, which is terrible, but yes.
Well, on that cheerful note, relatively at least, that does bring us to the end of today's show. Somnath Battabile and Michael Goldfarb, thank you both for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Augustin Macellari, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Pierre-Antoine Denis. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. Music next at 1900, The Entrepreneurs with Matt Alagaya. More on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Mullop. Thank you for listening.